Now, the diamond had a big bigger than what?
Well, if
for
we
what?
Continue where we left off, it was always jokingly said that the diameter had to be 255 feet to be bigger than Jodrell. And it was a great disappointment for Taffy and others when the diameter had to be cut down to 210 for cost reasons.
Did these other people have other things they want to do with the same amount of money?
Yeah.
Like what?
Well, the people like Christensen and Mills were strongly opposed to the idea of going on for Big Dish because they thought of it in part as a white elephant. It would eat up all the money, and it would change the character of the lab from a lab which was innovative and built its strength on innovation and new ideas to one that became just like any old astronomical observatory that would do things just because they had the telescope there and you had to observe with it. So there were very grim battles overall. The other people wanted to develop things like big arrays. If they'd had their way, it would have gone eventually to... Okay, thank you. It would have gone on eventually to something like a VLA, maybe, I don't know. But certainly Mills had plans after he'd got his first cross working and that he'd finished its usefulness. He had plans for a bigger cross to be built inside CSIRO, and it could not be built at the same time as the Parkes dish. So that's why he left, went to Sydney University. And Christensen really left for a similar sort of reason. But in the mid-50s, there was quite a battle going on, really, and Pawsey was a brilliant scientist, but he was somewhat weak as a character, in taking on seasoned veterans like Bowen or Bolton, who were... are plotters par excellence, and so Pawsey's influence was sort of declining through this great battle.
Now, was Pawsey with Bowen and wanting a big dish?
Pawsey couldn't ever quite make up his mind. That was very difficult. He was keen on both. And he could see the sense in a big dish. But he was also terribly interested in developing high-resolution instruments. And if he'd been left to himself, I think he would have done the high-resolution work and the rays. But he did join in the interest in the Parkes telescope, although in a slightly lukewarm sort of way. But he did take on the scientific planning of it very much, just because he was that kind of chap, that if there was a problem to be tackled, he'd certainly tackle it and do the best he could. And I was one who was very keen on the big dish because I got involved in 21 centimeter work, and obviously in that case the big dish was very suitable. And so I was one of those greatly in favour of it, and so I in a way became Taffy's assistant in getting the project through.
Would you like anything else?
I'd like hot tea, please.
Hot tea.
Yes, thanks.
You want to take a break to have a few bites?
Okay.
Okay, continuing with the Parkes dish development.
And so the project started, at least in Taffy Bowen's mind, somewhere about 1994, I suppose. But it really got going in, let's see,
That was, I know that.
In 57, yes, in 57 we already had somebody in London working with the engineers, so the contract for a design study had been let about 56 or 57. And, there's a quite interesting booklet. I should have shown it to you. That it was put out in something around 55, called The Case for a Giant Radio Telescope. That was put out for publicity purposes inside CSIRO, and also copies were given to members of parliament and so on. And I essentially wrote that, although my name isn't actually in it. It's as if it's written by Bowen. And at the back of it, it contains about seven or eight sketches of the possible ways of making a giant radio telescope, including a hole in the ground and all sorts of curious structures like that.
Let's see how this is going to turn out. I think this.
Okay, now that we've eliminated the vacuum cleaner.
I guess that was about 55 or so. And then and Taffy, in his quiet way, kept on plugging away at the sources of money and eventually sold the idea and at least got approval for a design study to begin with, and a pretty good understanding that the project would go ahead. In the meantime, Christensen and Mills, at least, no, Mills was still there. Christensen had left, and Mills was unhappy. But there was a committee set up to plan the thing from our end and work out the very detailed specification from the user's point of view. And one of our people, a person called Manette, Harry Manette, M-I-N-N-E-T-T, became the engineer in charge. He had been at the lab for quite a long time, since 1940 or so, and had been working in radar and civil aviation and on the outskirts of radio astronomy. So he was not an astronomer at all, but he came in as the engineer. Actually, he's still connected with the project in Sydney at present. I don't know if you met him.
No,
he's working on the optical telescope mainly at the moment, in the same sort of capacity.
You mean the Anglo-Australian?
Yeah. He's the essentially the chief liaison officer between users and contractors. He's got a strong engineering bias and understands what the users want and tries to interpret that into engineering terms and liaises with the actual design people.
Is that a verb, liaison? I never heard that one.
Well, it's a sort of a jargonistic verb anyway. Yeah. I don't know if it's in Webster. I see you know what it means. What it's meant to mean. As it turned out, he himself, I think, carried out a lot of the servo system design personally, just because their contracting people were not very good at that. So he was in London in 1957 when I was there briefly. I was spending a few months in Leiden and visited London two or three times in that the second half of 57. And he had been there for about a year at that stage. He was working hard with the engineers, Freeman Fox and partner, in London. In fact, I'd been corresponding with him from the Sydney end in quite enormous detail and did a lot more of it after I got back. As our users committee this is not the NRAO type of users committee, but the committee of the potential users of the telescope. We worked on what we thought we wanted in a telescope, and we produced some of the first ideas on digitizing telescopes and things like that. And Harry Monette at the London end tried to turn all of that sort of stuff into actual designed hardware, or designs for hardware. And that worked out pretty well. The final design is very well suited to easy operation, probably more so than any telescope before that, and probably more than for most since, because a great deal of thought went into the planning of its detailed, well, as would be said now, the interface between the user and the telescope. So, I suppose around about 1958, or towards the end of 58, the design study ended, and the firm contract was let. It was let with MAN in Germany, as you probably know. But to build a telescope in about 18 months at a price of, £500,000 or, no, £700,000 Australian, I think it was, or thereabouts.
That's the same group that's milling the bondage.
Right. Yeah. Yes, they started off in this business with the Parkes telescope. And they did a pretty good job, because there's almost nothing in what they did that anybody has ever found any fault with. Any criticisms that have been have usually been in somebody else's part of it. In troublesome relays and things like that. So, at about 1958, there was great activity in trying to decide on the site. This perhaps started in 57, but it really came to a pitch in 58. And the principal site hunter was MacCready at that stage, Lindsay MacCready. In the early stages, the hope was to try and get it to somewhere on the coastal plain, somewhere closer to Sydney than it in fact is. And he started off hunting around for possible sites within 100 miles of Sydney on the coastal plain. And there were two or three slightly possible sites, but it was realised eventually that these were all a bit risky, that there was too much development going on and they mightn't last long. So sometime in 58 we decided to move across the mountains and find something on the other side of the mountains. And three or four of us went around then in a group. We found several possible sites. There was a site near Cowra, C-O-W-R-A, which looked good for a while, beside the Macquarie River, and the site near Parkes. We chose not the present site, but one slightly closer to the town. And the Cowra one was eventually given up, because it looked as though a company that was interested in canning peas and so on was gradually spreading its activities in this direction, and it looked a bit unsafe. Also, too, the Cowra council, the town council, was not especially interested in us. On the other hand, the Parkes people, who could see exactly what this thing would do for Parkes, and
And they fell over backwards trying to offer us all sorts of assistance with roads and so on.
Mm.
And so it looked a much more friendly atmosphere there. And so one fateful day we went back again to show Duffy Bowen the site we'd selected near Parkes. And he was quite taken with it, and we all were again. But then we decided to go looking a bit further. And we started driving northwards from the site we had chosen as the first one. And about 3 or 4 miles further north, we found an even better site. And so, on that day, essentially, we decided to go there.
Better in what respect?
Well, a greater area of flat ground and somewhat more isolated, somewhat more distant from Parkes, and so more clear of electrical interference. The idea of flat ground was always very important in the site selection. I'm sure to a greater extent than in any other countries, the selections of a site. This is because of the great interest in crosses and other sorts of arrays, and so as a compromise with the people who'd been so interested in arrays, it was always stated that the site must be something with a quite large area of flat ground around it, so that an array that could be built centered on the Parkes dish, or including the 2 10-foot dish. And so we chose that the site is a very likely one, and on that same day started making inquiries about who owned the place. It turned out to be somebody called Osti Helm, H-E-L-M, and the Osti stands for Australia. Australia James Helm, is because he was born on the day on which the Australian Federation came into effect on January 1st, 1901. And we started to interview the town council people, and at that time the mayor of Parkes was a funny character called Cess Moon, and it was a typical country town in those days. It's become slightly more civilized since, but all transactions were carried out in the pub of Tattersall's Hotel. And Cess Moon used to tell us his story, his special personal story. He'd been a soldier, of course, in World War II, I suppose, World War II, yes. And he came back with a decoration of BSO. BSO means ball shot off. He used to tell us how he envied you chaps with two, because I've had plenty of fun with one. So those days, in that period, we visited Parkes quite a lot to establish contact with people and survey the site and so on. Of course, we lived at the pub and spent a lot of time establishing contact with the locals, which meant drinking in the bar more than anything else.
And it was a real chummy sort of situation.
Yeah. It was there that we learned that in that very dry atmosphere, you can drink beer forever and you don't notice it. Which is quite good. But on this first trip, as a matter of the fact, there was one a slightly dark note that I think it was the first trip, that a snake was seen on the site and was duly killed. But it's rather strange, because almost no other snakes have been seen ever since. But
you didn't know that might be infested.
Yeah. And so during that next year, as I say, some of us visited Parkes quite a lot, going up to establish contacts and so on. And one interesting story at that stage is that actual selection of the very precise spot where the centre of the telescope was going to be was surveyed by about three of us, Pawsey and MacCready and myself, I think. And I've got a picture in my slide collection of Pawsey actually measuring off the last bit with his with his tape and driving a post in to show where it was. But the interesting point is that a few weeks later, Taffy Bowen went up to their site very quietly with MacCready, and he got MacCready to take a picture of him driving the post in to show where the site was. And that picture has been published in various various propaganda journals.
So you would prefer if I choose a picture like that to use yours.
But at about that time, as I sort of implied earlier, Pawsey was dropping down in importance, unfortunately. And the sometime after the building started, which was in 59, we had a visit from John Bolton, who was then at Caltech. He came out to see us for a while, went up to Parks. In fact, I actually drove him up and back again. It dawned on us eventually that this was a deep, dark plot of Taffy's. Taffy was going to bring Bolton back again from Caltech and put him in charge of the whole Parks project over Pawsey's head. And that's what, in fact, happened. Although a sort of public meeting of the whole research staff was held at one stage to ask Taffy if this was in fact so, and he did the kind of wriggling, attempting to wriggle out of things that you'd expect the president to do. And he would not admit to having invited anybody to come back, and that if a post of officer in charge was to be set up, it would be properly advertised, and anybody could apply for it, and so on, in the normal way. However, a few months later, we heard that John Bolton was coming back to be officer in charge, and it had been all done in a very underhand way.
Had there been someone else in this post before, or was this just created?
It was created to come into effect. Well, actually, Bolton came out after the building process had gone about one-third through, and he spent most of his time at Parks during the final two-thirds watching over it and getting a pretty good acquaintanceship with the detailed construction and so on. Of course, that's what he enjoys more than anything else, poking around with bits of cable and digging holes and so on. That's his kind of astronomy. So shortly afterwards, Pawsey accepted the position of director of NRAO because he regarded himself as having been pushed out of radio physics. That was after Struve died. They had no director, and the place was in somewhat of a mess. It had not yet established itself as the leading organization in this country, and of feuds in all directions as to how much strength should be given to it, and so on.
This was 60 or so when Struve died.
It might have been 59, perhaps. Or perhaps, no, perhaps it was 60 years, because Pawsey were certainly present at the time when the telescope was commissioned, as we call it. We don't use the word dedicated. In 61.
Well, I just want to get across the point.
Yes, he must have come over in 62.
He accepted the post, but he never did take it, did he?
Well, he was... he thought it would be quite a challenge, and it was put to him that he was the only person who could bring all these rather dissident and competitive American radio astronomers together and make them into a group. And so he accepted that challenge, and he came over. It might have been late 61 or early 62. 62, probably. He came over intending to spend a few weeks looking around and surveying a scene and forming a policy. And then he was going back to Sydney for a few months before actually coming over to the job. However, he started to feel rather sick about a week before he left Sydney, but he still came over here and got very ill and was operated on. It was clear it was a brain tumour and that he had no possibility of recovering, really. But he came back to Australia for a few months before he died, finally, in late 62. But this was a very heart-rending thing in the whole history of the whole business, because all those who'd been on Pawsey's side in these arguments felt that he'd be very badly treated in the whole business, and that even his brain tumour might have been due to an emotional reaction to his bad treatment. Now, Pawsey was a great man, but he's one of the greatest men in the history of radio astronomy. Any history of him should pull out a lot of Pawsey's character in this. He was weak as an administrator, but he was extraordinary as a producer of ideas. And as a wonderful critic of ideas, too. He had enormous physical insight, and he could really pick the holes in a proposal or an argument very quickly.
Let me ask just one quick question. Who did become director at that time within REO?
Well, Hessian became acting director, or at least he was acting director, and he was slightly more positively confirmed as acting director, and then I suppose about a year later he was made director.
Now, back to Pawsey, can you just briefly describe which ideas, I mean, what he did scientifically? I'm not very familiar with what he did scientifically.
Well, he suffers rather in the way that he didn't publish a great deal himself. In fact, one of his very strong points has always been said to be that he had the ability to develop the latent powers in other people. That all the people who came out of that group, the Christensen, Mills, Wilde, and so on, count myself in it, that all of these people were sort of made independent and skillful in their subject and experienced, self-reliant, and so on, quite largely because of Pawsey's way of drawing people out. Pawsey was not the kind of research leader who'd insist on claiming everything himself, but he fed the ideas in that other people developed. And
he was really a teacher then.
Yes, he was a teacher as much as anything. And in the written record, you don't find his name on many papers, but he was the inspiration behind an awful lot.
Mm.
And, well, in a way, I suppose his work was done at the time when his influence dropped down, because his main work was in bringing other people up to a sort of equivalent status. And so it was time for him to start again in some other way.
Right. Do these other people that you've mentioned, do they acknowledge this influence of the
world? I'm sure Bolton wouldn't. Bolton would never acknowledge any debt to Pawsey, but all the others, yes. Yes, very much.
Okay, continuing with the Parkstich story, Bolton took over as officer in charge about one-third way through the construction.
Yes, that would have been early 1960, I suppose. And then the completion date was in 61. Let's see, it was probably about May, was it? Anyway, there's an article in... an article in Nature, not a letter, that reported the opening, really. I actually wrote it, but it's unsigned. It's one of their sort of pseudo-editorial reports. Mm. And this describes the day when the thing was officially commissioned. As I said, we don't use the word dedicated, which is only used as a religious thing.
And this was what date now?
It was in 61. I'm just trying to think exactly when it was. In the first half of the year. It was commissioned by the Governor General. Gee, which Governor General was it?
Well,
anyway, his name's in that article if you want it.
And this was the second largest dish at the time after the Java Bank.
Yes, but it could easily be claimed it was the best because its surface accuracy was much higher. So that by that time nobody worried too much about the drop in size. Incidentally, the drop in size is an amusing story in itself, because the first design was worked out for a size, something about 255 or 260 feet. But the design study also was supposed to include the rate of change of cost with the diameter. And they worked out that the cost would go as the something or other power of the diameter over a certain range. And the cost estimates for a 260-foot dish came out a bit too high, so it was scaled down to a 210-foot size. As it turned out, the cost of redesigning it for a smaller size, plus various slightly erroneous concepts in the scaling, finally resulted in the 210-foot one costing just about as much as the 261 would have.
So the same sort of surface accuracy?
Yeah. However, maybe if the 260 had actually been built, it might have cost more, I don't know.
Yeah.
But this was commissioned on some day early in 61, and this was a special day, and all sorts of preparations were made, all expecting great crowds of people, and there were display boards put up all over the paddock and so on, and the grand tours of people, and parliamentarians and town councillors and all sorts of people, plus hoi polloi and so on. Great crowds of people were expected. A special reserve for school kids and citizens of parks and so on. As it turned out, the day dawned with a very high wind on a supposedly windless site. And the whole ceremony went through. It was an open air ceremony, and there was a 50 mile wind blowing the whole time, 50 mile an hour wind, blowing dust all around us. And so the crowd that turned up was rather less than expected because it was such an awful day. And the ceremony didn't go too well because everybody was sort of just wishing it would be over.
Yeah.
And you couldn't hear the speakers too well because the wind blowing into the microphone produced such a terrific noise. And I know at the end of it, I've never seen such a dirty shirt as the one I took off, with so much dust having been attached to it by the sweat and so on. Then afterwards, there was a special entertainment, or a reception rather. And this is another funny story. There were two classes of tickets to this opening day, the pink tickets and the blue tickets. And if you got a pink ticket, you could come to the reception at the present visit, the present residence, at which the Governor General was present and all his entourage. If you had blue tickets, you went to a reception in a tent, and that's where the ordinary crowd went to, of course. The important people, such as Bart and Bock and all the senior radiophysics staff and various university people and town councillors and so on, were all asked to the high class reception. However, Harry Messel, the professor of physics at Sydney University, and Bernie Mills, the famous radio astronomer, were given blue tickets, and they had theirs in the tent because of Taffy's hostility to them.
Oh, it was purposeful.
Oh, yeah, it's very purposeful. And the Daily Telegraph, the slightly second-rate Sydney Daily newspaper, the Sydney Morning newspaper, carried a photograph the next day, which was also rather purposeful. The only photograph shown was one of Harry Messel and Bart Bock and Bernie Mills, seen together with the telescope in the background, as if they owned it. That was also purposefully done by Harry Messel as part of this long argument between those two. And
Where did Messel fit in? You haven't mentioned him before.
Yes, well, Messel is another character. If you don't know Messel, you haven't lived, sort of thing. He's an ex-Canadian. He's got a very flamboyant red beard. He never stops talking. I suppose he knows some physics, or he used to 10 or 20 years ago. But he's mostly an operator and a collector of money, and he's done pretty well at bringing money into physics. He's formerly a cosmic ray person, and he's a character in Sydney to the extent that if a newspaper cartoonist wants to show a scientist going to the moon, they show Harry Messel, and so on. And he's got strong friends and strong enemies, of course, as you'd expect from this type of person. And Taffy Bowen and he are great enemies, although I suspect most of the enmity's on Bowen's side, really. Well, the place where he comes into the story is that when Bernie Mills could not get support at Radiophysics for his Big Cross project, Harry Messel took him in. And Mills is a professor in the physics department, which is run by Harry Messel.
At the University of Sydney.
At the University of Sydney. So that's where he comes in.
No, after the commissioning of the telescope, was it shakedown sort of trials, or had they already taken place? Observations began right away?
But some trials had taken place before, it was already a sort of working system, but the things you could call shakedown trials went on for a few months after that, really, before it really got going in a proper way.
And just to finish up, what were the first observations that were, true observations that were done on it?
Oh dear. It's hard to pick the exact moment. The first observation I ever did, I think I was looking at the moon as a calibration source, and all I could get was radar pulses. That was on 408 megahertz, and from the time that they cut off, we worked out that the transmitter responsible must have been in Hawaii. Mm. Or thereabouts, and that was a period when there were various military projects going on in this country about using the moon for spying on it, bomb explosions and all that sort of thing. So these projects were all secret, and you couldn't find out where the pulses were coming from. But
do you don't remember specifically which program was first scheduled on the dish?
I don't really, because things came in rather gradually. The first observations were purely of a test nature. There were some nice records of things like Papasai showing it resolved, and showing it as a double source, which hadn't been seen before. Observations of Jupiter.
That's all right. I mean, that's something that can be checked. Yeah.
I'm sure that there's something in the written record somewhere about. There's one of the first really new scientific observations coming out of it was the polarization of Centaurus A. This was rather a heart-burning thing for Taffy Bowen too, because this happened at a time when Ron Bracewell was visiting and was at the telescope, and Bracewell was actually visiting the University of Sydney, and so he had no connection with CSIRO, but he was he and Cooper were responsible for this great new discovery, and there was terrible arguing between Bowen and Messel as to how this should be published, because Bowen tried his hardest to exclude Bracewell completely from it.
And what was the end result?
It ended up as a paper by Cooper and Bracewell, or Bracewell and Cooper.
I mean, where is this?
I think it's Nature, probably. There's been a long tradition of first discoveries being in Nature, as you know.
Right. Well, thank you very much. I think it's obvious we're going to have another session sometime, but
okay.
I think that's enough for now. You say this report was written in 1957 by...
In 1957, Yardley Beers, that's B-E-E-R.